Tom Bombadil is an enigma, a puzzling riddle who continues to baffle and confuse readers and those critics who endeavor to explain him. Tolkien describes him as an intentional enigma. He is, therefore, meant to be a mystery. He is nonetheless an important character who we ignore at our peril. Joseph Pierce.
Clifford, back for another one.
Yes, indeed. How are you, Patrick?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well. Doing well. I'll save my updates for the end. But
all right, Clifford, what are we talking about today?
We are on Chapter 7 of The Fellowship of the Ring, in the house of Tom Bombadil.
What'd we think?
Mysterious man. I have to say, I'm quite fond of this character.
I know, I love this chapter. This is another chapter. Super into. Mm-hmm. I was editing the third chapter with the elves today. Or not today, but this week leading up to this. And that's probably my favorite chapter, but this one rivals it for the early chapters.
Agreed.
All right, what are we going to talk about today? All right, so basically we're going to just kind of talk in order, almost in order. We're going to go through the feast that night and then their fireside talking, the dreams, the day off the next day where they're talking with Tom the whole time. And then we're going to save for the end discussing who actually is Tom Bombadil, just to leave suspense. But also that's what I kind of figured was the best way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, Cliff's notes.
So, the dazed and bewildered hobbits, having been saved by Tom Bombadil at the end of the last chapter and let through the river valley, find themselves in the dark, cozy house of Tom Bombadil. They are greeted by the splendid Goldberry, who inspires Frodo to spontaneously break into song. Tom and Goldberry treat the group to a feast, and then they head to bed, exhausted and content. Frodo, Merry, and Pippin all have nightmares. They awake the next morning to a gray, rainy day, and resolve to spend it inside with Tom, his food, and his stories. The hobbits learn more about Tom Bombadil, but mysteries remain. Tom gives them advice for traveling forwards and teaches them a song to sing if they get into a pinch.
Awesome. That was pretty quick. That was quicker than usual. Well, I guess nothing much happened in this chapter.
Yeah, it's an intriguing chapter that's pretty light on plot, I'd say.
Yeah,
I didn't want to spoil too much.
Okay, all right. Yeah, well, we'll get into it, I guess. All right. So, yeah, I guess we'll start with the feast. So it immediately starts, they come right into the cottage because that's where they left off at the last chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And it immediately feels to me like the Cottage of Lost Play with all the light and everything.
Yeah.
Did you get that vibe?
We got vivid descriptions of candlelight on a large wooden table, candles hanging from the rafters up in the ceiling, a very colorful Goldberry sitting in the corner surrounded by little clay vessels filled with water lilies.
Do you just want to read the description of Goldberry?
Yeah, sure. In a chair at the far side of the room, facing the outer door, sat a woman. Her long yellow hair rippled down her shoulders. Her gown was green, green as young reeds, shot with silver like beads of dew, and her belt was of gold, shaped like a chain of flag lilies set in the pale blue eyes of forget-me-nots. About her feet, in wide vessels of green and brown earthenware, white water lilies were floating, so that she seems to be enthroned in the midst of a pool.
Mm.
Pretty impressive for falling into someone's house, I'd say.
Yeah, it was. So throughout this chapter, one of the authors, Fleming Rutledge, she pointed out that Frodo was basically totally smitten by Goldberry the
yes.
entire chapter.
Yes.
And she also pointed out how Sam was basically like supremely attracted to the elves back in the third chapter when we met them. And she was kind of pointing out that, well, Sam's a pretty kind of, you know, child of the earth as you can get, basically. Mm-hmm. Whereas Frodo's more like a contemplative, like higher thinker a little bit.
Okay, interesting.
And so the elves kind of are like the higher thinkers too. So Sam was attracted to that, but then Frodo is attracted to like this kind of spirit of the forest or nature, you know, which is Goldberry, which is so opposites attract in both cases, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, very, very interesting. That's a good analysis.
Yeah, she had the quote here. Sam is drawn to the transcendent. Frodo is attracted to the earthy, and each of them becomes more truly himself in the process. Yeah. But anyways, so they start going on with this feast, and like I think they're getting the table ready, and Tom's just taking care of the ponies and walking around and everything. And there was the one line: every now and again, they caught among a many Derrydull and Marydull, and a ring-a-ding-dillo, the repeated words: "Old Tom Bombadil is a merry fellow. Bright blue is his jacket, and his boots are yellow." It was like, I don't know. I mean, we met the character in the last chapter, but this guy's such a weirdo.
Yes, he's definitely very peculiar.
Yeah.
But, I mean, bright blue jacket, yellow boots, not all that weird.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, it's kind of funny. Like,
I'm would thinking you ever, like, old woodsman in, like, big yellow rubber rain boots.
Yeah. Would you ever, do you ever walk around and sing what items of clothing you're wearing?
No, rarely.
Actually, I feel like I might have done that at some point, but notably, before Tom gets back in the room, Frodo asks Goldberry, like, well, who is he? Like, what is up with this? Like, where are we? What's going on and everything? But we're going to save that till the end, like I said.
Yes.
But, yeah, yes. But this whole, the whole dinner scene with Tom and Goldberry and, like, all the light in this cottage and the nice meal and everything, this is another example of Tolkien's masterclass at just capturing, like, the sense of wonder.
And we see even in the chapter, I'd say Tom Bombadil and Goldberry are just completely like enrapturing.
Yeah.
You know, Frodo and the other hobbits, their entire focus and existence is like directed towards watching this peculiar couple and paying attention to them. And you get the same sense in the chapter, like the reader is sucked in a similar way. In these other encounters we've had with people in the past, like, I feel like there's a little bit more deft in terms of, like, okay, Frodo's trying to play it close to the vest, and what's he going to let on, and what are the ulterior motives of these characters? And here, it's like we've jumped into a different realm where we, the readers, and the hobbits are just regarding these two with wonder and don't know what to make of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, the feast.
Yeah, the feast itself, it sounded kind of like Bjorn-style meal, you know, like the vegetarian kind of thing. Bread, honey,
For those of you who don't remember, Bjorn is was the bear man from The Hobbit who Bilbo and the dwarves encountered just before walking into Mirkwood.
Yeah. Is it like, is that an English thing to not really cook your food and have just plain stuff? It always sounds kind of, not really plain, but like just, I don't know, cold.
It's always struck me as like, it's like a sort of like a farmer's spread or something.
Yeah.
Like the cream and the cheese are like definitely obviously products from cows.
Yeah.
Like it's not like it's super rustic because you need like a agriculture to make a lot of those things, but they seem like sort of very pure fruits of the land type foods. Like it's not overwrought with like labor, cooking, preparation, that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like anytime we have these meals, which, you know, this is already, we're probably on, I don't even know, we're past at least one hand worth of meals already. But like every time he has these, I assume this is all just stuff that he would have in, that either he liked or that was common, a common kind of delicacy in the English countryside, I would assume, based on kind of what we've read. But yeah, and these things, you seems like you can find all of them there too.
Yeah,
what they were drinking at the dinner, the clear cold water, yet it went to their hearts like wine and set free their voices. The guests became suddenly aware that they were singing merrily, as if it were easier and more natural than talking. Another cool feature of this chapter.
You're just, everyone's singing, just breaking time. Into song.
Yeah. we were kind of talking about the, well, I don't know. Yeah, we already brought up the comparison to the elves in the third chapter compared to this. And so it seems like the elves, I don't know. Do we want to say they were like borderline like heavenly? Do we want to say that?
Yeah, I mean, we talked at that point about them being angelic, like seeming to have like this glow around them, both like an actual, in terms of actual light and sort of like a spiritual power. And I to that point, I feel like you've got a similar thing going on here.
Except this is more earthy.
Right.
A little bit.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, Fleming Rutledge has the other quote here. If the Elven Feast suggests the messianic banquet, Tom's spread is reminiscent of the milk and honey flowing in the land promised to the children of Israel. Milk and honey.
Okay. Yeah. That is an important, I guess, pairing that we had with both Bjorn and this feast now.
Another thing about this meal. Have you noticed that this book's been divided basically like 50-50 between party and feast scenes and actual plot / journeying? Like, if anything, it's more so parties and feasts.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if that was either totally intentional or even a crutch that is very useful for driving forward, introducing new concepts into the story and driving forward like historical development through conversation.
It is what you're saying there, but it's definitely because he didn't really know where he's going with the story. So he's having fun with it at those parts.
That's pretty interesting.
Cause I mean, like in the Old Forest chapter and in this chapter, I mean, the plot doesn't really get forwarded at all, with the ring at least, you know?
Right.
I mean, like, the story gets much deeper and more depth because of these characters, but it does not. Yeah, this is what? We already had Bilbo's whole party for the first chapter. Gandalf and Frodo were talking for the second chapter, so we won't even count that. But then we had Gildor, we had a Farmer Maggot, we had Crick Hollow, and now we have this. So yeah, it's already like,
but all those conversations have been really critical for setting up what we know about the story.
Right. Yeah. Whereas
the way that Tolkien writes plot is very explanatory and detailed, but he doesn't offer a lot of, I guess you would call it like third person omniscient type thing, where you were getting inside the heads of the individual characters in a very significant way.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, that it's an interesting use of the banquets. And then I was also thinking, to your point, that not that much has happened plot-wise, is I feel whether Tolkien knew it or not, or, you know, certainly by the end he's sort of constructing it, it's like it's really hard to pin down a plot for this book. Like, the big plot that we're talking about, that we've gotten the start of, that we... of Frodo and the ring, is like, if you wrote just that into a book, it would be, I don't know, the length of like one of the books.
Right? Oh, like the history of the ring, like straightforward.
No, just like Frodo and the ring, and that was it for this book. And there's nothing else going on. It would be a way shallower and shorter story.
Oh yeah. But I mean, well, I think we talked about in the last chapter, Bombadil had already been invented. And so he just used him because he had him on hand. Like, he needed some sort of adventure for him. Because what you just said, like, it's going to be too shallow. But, I mean, that was the reasoning for this.
Okay.
Like, I mean, he's completely putting emphasis on almost recovery times over the dangerous parts. At least
right.
Which, that, in fairness, like I've said, if you watch the movies and you're coming to read the books, it's like you're going through this and it's like, wow, this is just taking forever. Like, this is so much. Mm-hmm. But it's like, well, yeah, but you got to realize, like, this stuff's really good in itself. Yeah, it's not as exciting as the movie scenes, I guess, but...
Right.
This
chapter, notably, for anyone following very closely along, probably knows this is among the most significant omissions from the movies.
Yeah, they left out Bombadil just because it's like he's going to be way too hard to explain to the audience. He also doesn't forward the ring plot very much.
Correct.
Yeah. They're sitting near the fire, though, after the meal,
which
that's another nice touch. Applewood fire.
Yes.
And so Goldberry goes to bed. And I think she kissed the hobbits goodnight, each of them. Did she kiss him? Maybe she didn't kiss him. I don't know. I think she, whatever. She said goodnight to him.
They're all dreaming that they kissed her.
Yeah. So there's a bit, probably other stuff to talk about with Tom himself, but the biggest thing that Frodo brought up here was, he asked, did you hear me calling Master, or was it just chance that brought you at that moment? So he's referring to when they were, Frodo was calling out when the Willow had eaten Merry and Pippin.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tom's response was, Tom stirred like a man shaken out of a pleasant dream. Eh, what? He said, did I hear you calling? Nay, I did not hear. I was busy singing. Just chance brought me then, if chance you call it. So, this gives back to our old theme that we've had since, like, chapter 3 of The Hobbit of chance in this book.
Mm-hmm. Do we call it luck? Do we call it happenstance?
Yeah, we gotta define chance again.
Do we go, yeah, or does it mean something different here? For those of you who are listening along in The Hobbit, I think we talked about this quite a bit, but certainly a lot of these events are much more significant than just chance, and it's not really a situation of luck, is the impression that we've got. And our interpretation has been that we're really looking at something more like divine providence, or like there's a clear direction with the way these things happen, even if they seem happenstance.
Yeah, in this case, Bombadil says in that same paragraph he wasn't planning to see them, but he had heard news of them, so he expected to meet them at some point, but in that moment, it's not like he was looking for them.
Right.
One of Tom Shippey's books, they were bringing up to Gandalf and Thorin. Originally, when they were planning out The Hobbit, it was just a chance meeting that brought them together, and from that chance meeting, they realized that they would be a good partnership to defeat Smaug and all of, like, the northern evil forces, basically all together wrapped in one. And so Shippey has the line, the suggestion both times is that chance is just a word people use to explain things they do not understand, but that this is a sign only of the limits of their understanding. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. So he's saying people call it chance, but chance is our way of understanding these things that are beyond us sometimes. Yeah. So, in other words, there very well could be, and maybe are, larger forces at play, or decisions being made, or what, you know, however you want to frame it, like people's paths crossing in the future and in the past, and what we perceive to be random is not always so random. So,
indeed,
basically, that's what we've got going on here with Tom Bombadil.
Yeah.
Or so Tom Bombadil would suggest.
Anything else on this section?
No, I was going to say that it reminds me a little bit of when we were talking about this type of thing for The Hobbit. We kind of brought up this, like, the concept of intentionality. Bilbo finding the dwarves after being separated from them seems like, okay, is it pure luck? Was it destined to happen? And there's kind of like an interesting reading that, like, Bilbo really, like, desired to find his friends, and because that was so central and so focused for him, it was therefore, like, much more likely, if not bound to happen, that he was going to find them, because it was at the center of his mind. So, like, his personal direction and intentions played into his destiny, sort of.
How would you relate that to here?
Well, so Tom saying, like, he's aware of Frodo and he kind of knew of things going on. He's, like, kind of already in the context of crossing paths with Frodo.
But in that moment, he was focused on, and he was literally singing about carrying water lilies home to Goldberry.
It's right. Not like he was trying the implication is, like, you don't have control of the specifics of the moments of, like, what's going to pop out at you when, or... There's all these things that are still out of your control, no matter how powerful you are, but the prospect that you're going to cross paths with someone or that you're near someone else still has pull.
I feel like it's more so in that situation when Frodo was calling out for help, he was the one really desiring to, like, save his friends right in that second.
Sure.
And yeah, let's move on.
Okay.
All right, these dreams, you got much to say Frodo has a dream. I don't know how we can talk about Frodo's dream without it being like a massive spoiler.
Well, let's describe what they are, because I brushed over them only really briefly in Cliff's notes. Frodo dreams of this giant rock tower. Dark. There's a thin moon rising. There's an old man with white hair on top of this giant rock tower with a staff. Shadows in the sky. And the man with the white hair launches something like a lightning bolt out of his staff, and then an eagle swoops down and carries him off. And there's howls and cries from below in the dark.
And there's Black Rider hooves.
Oh, yes. Black Rider hoofbeats after that.
And Frodo thought that was more so just right outside the house.
Yeah, so he wakes up at a start thinking that the Black Riders are coming for him.
Yeah.
And then Pippin has this very specific nightmare of trees, the house creaking, cracking, crunching. If you remember in the last chapter, he got sucked into a willow tree. So he basically has a flashback of being eaten by a willow.
Yeah, that sucks.
And then Mary is dreaming of the house getting flooded with water and of drowning.
And that's another creepy one.
Yeah.
And then, kind of weird that they had nightmares like that in such a pleasant place, you know?
Right. It gave like a little bit of a spooky tone to this whole thing. Like, maybe it's too good to be true. They've been lulled to sleep in the way that like milk and honey can be kind of seductive, that, you know, maybe they've fallen for this stranger who is singing and everything is beautiful, and it means that like it's too good to be true and something's rotten underneath the surface. Or alternately, that they're in a place where like magic or the forces of the world are so like focused or warped or something that strange things are happening like inside and outside of their head all the time.
Or look, maybe it kind of sets up their lazy day that they have the next day, because it kind of puts them in the mood to be too scared to go out.
True.
I don't know. Sam slept like a log, notably.
Trusty Sam. Yeah. When everything else is going wrong, we can always count on Sam to just be holding steady.
Next part?
Yes. So it's all gray the next day. Tom
rainy
says...
rainy outside?
Yeah. Although, you know, you'd think they could handle it if the Shire is actually the English countryside.
Yeah, that's what I said too. Like, what the hell?
But Tom...
like, I mean, yeah.
Tom says that tells them they should stay dry and take it easy for the day, and they seem to concur pretty easily.
Yeah, it kind of feels like a snow day.
Right.
When you hear that, you know, it's like, oh, phew, thank God we don't have to go do this or something. Mm-hmm. But I actually thought it felt most like, you know, like a high school retreat.
Okay.
Like, you know, because I feel like most of those things, too, they were in the spring and it was always rainy. And yeah, it's just like some crappy Thursday, but you get the day off. So it's like, all right, this is cool.
Yeah.
I'll do whatever.
Uh-huh. So Tom says it's a good day for long tales, for questions and for answers.
Yeah, sitting by the cozy fire, too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, let's read one of the descriptions. Should we do the one of the old forest first?
Sure. As they listened, they began to understand the lives of the forest, apart from themselves. Indeed, to feel themselves as the strangers where all other things were at home. Moving constantly in and out of his talk was Old Man Willow, and Frodo learned now enough to content him. Indeed, more than enough. It was not a comfortable lore. Tom's words laid bare the hearts of trees and their thoughts, which were often dark and strange, and filled with a hatred of things that go free upon the earth, gnawing, biting, breaking, hacking, burning, destroyers and usurpers. It was not called the Old Forest without reason, for it was indeed ancient, a survivor of vast forgotten woods, and in it there lived, yet, aging no quicker than the hills, the fathers of trees, remembering times when they were lords. The countless years had filled them with pride and rooted wisdom, and with malice. But none were more dangerous than the great willow. His heart was rotten, but his strength was green. And he was cunning, and a master of winds. And his song and thought ran through the woods on both sides of the river. His gray, thirsty spirit drew power out of the earth, and spread like fine root threads in the ground. and invisible twig fingers in the air, till it had under its dominion nearly all the trees of the forest from the hedge to the downs. Whoa.
Cool.
Yeah, that's a pretty epic description of a forest right there.
I know. Who else can do that besides Tolkien?
I don't know.
I actually like to hear other names, but yeah.
I read a book a little while back that was called The Overstory, and the premise was that...
Is that your tree book?
Yeah, it's all about trees. Have I mentioned this already?
I think in our walking special.
Okay.
The one at Rocky Mountain.
Okay. Well, anyways.
Yeah. Go on.
It came out recently, won some awards, maybe some of you have read it, but... I didn't totally love the book by the end, but the story is it's a multi-part story, but it's all tied together by trees. And there's a lot of really cool information and great description of trees in there. And it reminds me of this, actually, because the author's very eloquent and poetic, talking about trees and their ancient powers and that type of thing. But it's also rooted in science and how we understand forests now. And what's kind of crazy is, like, some of these things are not that far off from the way forests work. Like, we know now that trees communicate with each other through, like, tiny filaments in the ground. Like, basically they have sort of root threads, and mushrooms are part of the zoo, I think, where they're able to send signals to each other. And like there's all this sort of stuff that sounds magic or fantastical to us, because if, like, we are raised to say, like, yeah, a tree is a tree and a forest is just a bunch of trees, and we're slowly learning that like science is actually backing up some of the more, like, mythical descriptions of trees as some having some sort of life force or power or something like that, which I think is really cool.
That is really cool. Yeah, but I mean, it made the hobbits feel even more like strangers being there, though.
Absolutely.
And it seems like the trees were kind of just upset that they're not the kings of the forest anymore.
Yeah, this little section right here, I think, maybe is a good introduction, foreshadowing, something like that. But it sets up what for me is a pretty important part of this book and whole series, is, like, underlying what would be considered, like, regular plot, like, occurrences. There are these other, like, more abstract forces and sensations going on, like the trees, which are ancient and are angry at having constantly been cut down, and you're super aware of the passage of time. Like, the trees themselves are really, really ancient and have witnessed so many things happen, and they're moving at, like, they're in a different storyline. Like, they're moving at a different pace and everything from the hobbits, who are moving at a different pace from Tom Bombadil. So it's like different trains on different tracks, all moving at different speeds, but they're all passing each other right now at the same time. That's a really cool, super deep world creation, you know?
Yeah.
Which that is awesome, which is a really awesome thing about this book. So pay attention to that as we go forward. It's like this... I like to think of it as, like, the background, like, sense of time or something like that.
You want to do you want to read the neighbor of the old forest, the Barrow Downs?
Yes, more spooky stuff. Suddenly Tom's talk left the woods and went leaping up the young stream, over bubbling waterfalls, over pebbles and worn rocks, and among small flowers and close grass and wet crannies, wandering at last up onto the downs. They heard of the great barrows, and the green mounds, and the stone rings upon the hills and in the hollows among the hills. Sheep were bleating in flocks. Green walls and white walls rose. There were fortresses on the heights. Kings of little kingdoms fought together, and the young sun shone like fire on the red metal of their new and greedy swords. There was victory and defeat, and towers fell. Fortresses were burned, and flames went up into the sky. Gold was piled on the biers of dead kings and queens, and mounds covered them, and the stone doors were shut, and the grass grew all over. Sheep walked for a while, biting the grass, but soon the hills were empty again. A shadow came out of dark places far away, and the bones were stirred in the mounds. Barrow whites walked in the hollow places with a clink of rings on cold fingers and gold chains in the wind. Stone rings grinned out of the ground like broken teeth in the moonlight.
Hmm. Whoa.
Yeah, another, I mean, just like the last chapter, amazing condensed description of what we take to be like a really long passage of time. Like this could be, you know, like the history of medieval England or something like that, of like an uninhabited land fills up with people. Slowly they build little fiefdoms. They fight with each other and then they you know, it all comes to pass. And that's just like condensed into the background of this, I guess what we assume to be like spooky burial mounds in close proximity to where they are.
Right. And Tom's been there for all this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll get to that shortly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, well, we can start a little bit here. I mean, he's clearly very, very old.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, again, like all this stuff, it's like, are we advancing the main plot of the story right now? By no means.
No.
I mean,
no.
We've almost forgotten about the Black Riders, and we've almost forgotten about the ring itself. Besides that, there's a scene with it here soon.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but we're clearly adding so much more to the story with this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And by we, I mean Token exclusively. but yeah, there is another. Actually, what do you think I'm talking about when I said Tom starts talking of older things, page 128?
When they caught his words again, they found that he had now wandered into strange regions beyond their memory and beyond their waking thoughts, into times when the world was wider and the seas flowed straight to the western shore. And still on and back Tom went singing out into ancient starlight, when only the elf sires were awake. Then suddenly he stopped, and they saw that he nodded as if he was falling asleep. And it seemed as if, under the spell of his words, the wind had gone, and the clouds had dried up, and the day had been withdrawn, and darkness had come from east and west, and all the sky was filled with the light of white stars.
Oh, this chapter's the best.
I know. I mean, this is in the... We don't even know how long Tom is talking or what kind of, you know, narrator he is, but we're winding the clock back on Middle Earth, all the way back to the formation of this world, like back to, like it's like a Genesis in reverse or something like that, where we're peeling right back the layers of development, like until all that's left are stars.
And I feel like it's not like this guy's super diligent outlined story here. I feel like, you know, he's probably just whimsically weaving throughout all this stuff, and
right.
The hobbits are just spellbound listening to it. But there was this good quote here from, again, from Fleming Rutledge. He, that's Bombadil, appears in the role of Griot, the keeper of the ancestral memory, the one who sits by the bonfire and recites the ancient tales. I would like that job. That'd be a cool job to have.
Awesome job.
The hobbits listen spellbound as he tells of the world in primal days. His recital is like a version of the first chapter of Genesis. Oh, Clifford, you're already hitting this. And it evokes a sort of rapture in the hearers as they feel themselves in the presence of a witness to the creation. Again, as with the elves, it's an invocation of paradise, only this time with an earthier flavoring.
Yeah. I mean, it brings to mind, is he just a spectator for this? He comes off as being very humble, like just this kind of goofy guy in the woods. But he's talking as though he's witnessed the formation of the entire world, which would suggest that he's an ancient, powerful creature. Character,
ooh.
Something like that.
We're almost there, but we still got to do a little bit more setup before we finally answer who he is. Okay.
Anyways, pretty fascinating storytelling from Tom Bombadil. The hobbits are enchanted. They're certainly learning a lot. We can't say necessarily that they're, advancing their quest specifically. But if anything, it gives me the sense that they're now very aware that they're walking on loaded ground or something like that.
Yeah.
Like they're now super conscious of like the ground under their feet being part of the forest, which is under the spell of the willow tree, or they're stepping on the barrows, which have this whole history of development and conflict and burials, and it's like nothing, there's no like innocent territory anymore, which is maybe just like a really good, maybe that's like a really good history class or something, is like,
right, yeah.
Everything is loaded with history and background.
I know, I wish like somebody could come up to us and talk about it for us, like with our where we live, you know. All right, one last description here, and then we got to talk about the probably the most notable scene of the book. All right, so they, after like the day of sitting near the fire and listening to Tom ramble on, even though it was all awesome, it was clearly rambling, they have to have another dinner. And so as they set the table, there's just, let's just read the description of that. So quickly he returned bearing a large and laden tray. Then Tom and Goldberry set the table, and the hobbits sat half in wonder and half in laughter. So fair was the grace of Goldberry, and so merry and odd the caperings of Tom. Yet in some fashion they seemed to weave a single dance, neither hindering the other, in and out of the room, and around about the table. And with great speed food and vessels and lights were set in order. The boards blazed with candles, white and yellow. Tom bowed his head to his guests. "Supper is ready," said Goldberry, and now the hobbits saw that she was clothed all in silver with a white girdle, and her shoes were like fish's mail. But Tom was all in clean blue, blue as rain-washed forget-me-nots, and he had green stockings. Okay, so after dinner, Goldberry goes to bed again. She must be an early riser. Mm-hmm. Actually, she was, because she was doing all the chores that whole day, like washing all the clothes or something.
Well, she was gone, like, most of the day, right? We got right. The description of she kind of disappeared out into the rain.
Yeah, it was like the last fall washing or something until spring. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But after dinner, Tom starts asking them questions, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Because it says he already knew much about them, their families, and the Shire, probably more than hobbits even remember.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically admits that he had heard news. He had somehow received news from Gilder and Farmer Maggot.
Right.
Which the Farmer Maggot one was super interesting because he said there's earth under his old feet and clay on his fingers, wisdom in his bones, and both his eyes are open. So
yeah, I really like that description.
Yeah, whatever that means, that's how he got the information.
well, so I read a few things into that. One, they pointed out that, or we got the impression that Frodo and the other hobbits didn't put as much significance, as much weight on Farmer Maggot as they, or they just didn't give him all that much significance. But clearly, Tom Bombadil, who's an important character, was giving him a lot of significance, and that made, I think, Frodo and the hobbits pause and reconsider things for a second.
I think to be fair, Merry kind of knew about it, but Merry wasn't there for that scene.
Okay. And then there's the suggestion that maybe Farmer Maggot somehow communicated directly or indirectly with Tom Bombadil, and Tom Bombadil is saying, "This is a good man. Like, he's real salt of the earth. He's attached to the earth, basically, and yeah, that represents his goodness and his knowledge." Or is like Farmer Maggot is just a guy, but because he's attached to the earth, because there's clay on his fingers, that somehow speaks to me, because we've got this implication that Tom is whatever he is very tied to the environment and his surroundings.
I would say probably a combination of both, but I would almost lean towards the first one a little bit, because in the early, I think in the Adventures of Tom Bombadil, like the separate book, I don't know about the first version, but I think there was a version re-released after Lord of the Rings of like the Adventures of Tom Bombadil, and that he's mostly just like he's fighting with like the Willow Man and he's saving Goldberry or something, and then they get married. But I think, and he fights with the, with something that's on the Burrow Downs, which I won't reveal because it spoils the next chapter. But I think he goes to like, I think he goes into Buckland to the Brandywine River, and Farmer Maggot teaches him how to work a raft, I think. Sure. So I think there was an original or newly developed connection where they're actual friends, like flesh and blood.
More literal communication.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, anyways, Tom's questioning them all, and he's such a good questioner that Frodo's divulging stuff more than he had ever said to Gandalf about like his hopes and Bilbo and everybody.
Mm-hmm. Kind of what we were saying earlier is like Frodo and the hobbits are so enamored with Tom and Goldberry that they're like, their guard is just totally down. They're not thinking about any ulterior motives or self-defense or playing it close to the vest or anything. They're just like, okay.
Yeah. And then Tom gets a glint in his eye and he says, show me the precious ring. And Frodo just gives it over easily. Like, what you're saying, like, completely enamored. There is no guard.
Certainly, and Gandalf, who Frodo loves and respects, when Gandalf asks to hand it over, Frodo is super reticent and doesn't want to do it. So this is a very peculiar situation.
And Tom inspects it, and then he laughs, and then what happens?
He puts it on, and nothing happens. Which is weirder than anything else happening, really.
Right, I know. Yeah, like, yeah. So even if you're like reading through this and you're slogging through this for the first time and you're just like, when's something interesting going to happen? Because you don't appreciate this stuff yet, which is why you listen to this show. Even at that point, you're still going, whoa, that's crazy. Everybody has to, you know?
Right.
So long as you comprehended what you had just read, it's like, whoa. And then at some point, he even makes the ring disappear. You read that part too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Frodo almost gets kind of mad about that. Like, he's just like, well, because Frodo kind of remembers, like, well, this is kind of a, not kind of, this, he knows this is a big deal, and Tom's just treating it like a joke. So Frodo, he's so mad that he ends up putting the ring on himself just to make sure that it actually works, and that makes him feel reassured, which is ironic. Because he shouldn't, you know, up until this point, he had never wanted the ring to be so powerful or around with him, you know.
Right.
But Mary can't see him, but then Tom can still see him even when he's invisible, which is funny.
Yeah, there's a pretty funny line in there. Hey there, cried Tom. Hey, come Frodo, there. Where be you a-going? Old Tom Bombadil's not as blind as that yet. Take off your golden ring. Your hand's more fair without it. Come back, leave your game, and sit down beside me. So, you know, he sounds like, you know, like a jolly old goofball who's just like, he's unaffected by the ring. He's making light of this whole situation. And this is totally different from everything else we've gotten surrounding the ring, which is like dark and heavy. And like Frodo feels like the weight of the world is on it.
All right, so with all that said, let's dive into it. Who is this guy? So first I want to bring up, at the beginning of the chapter, before Tom even got into the house when he was taking care of the ponies, Frodo does ask this to Goldberry. He says, who is Tom Bombadil? And Goldberry's response is just,
he is.
So
Frodo's like, okay, and?
Yeah. Well, and then she additionally says, he is, as you have seen him. He is the master of wood, water, and hill. So then they kind of go on, like, master, like, Frodo asks, is like, well, is he the owner of the forest or anything? And she's like, oh, God, no. Like, that's way too much of a burden. Not that. Which makes me think he's just, like, kind of the tamer or, like, the karate master, you know, a karate kind of
whisperer type thing.
I think tamer is the best word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she said something to the extent of, no, every bit of this forest is its own master.
Right.
Everything controls itself. Tom is just the...
Or like the ringleader almost, even.
The one who knows it best.
Yeah, so where I see in... It's kind of hard to say what Tom is, but what he does is on full display of throughout this chapter and throughout like the last chapter and maybe in the future. We'll see.
Right.
But anyways... During the day, they have the, throughout that whole long conversation, after Tom was talking about, like, the really old things, the, like, all the shores and the fairies, elf sires and everything, Frodo asks him, who are you, master? And then Tom's answer, you want to read that?
And what, said Tom, sitting up, and his eyes glinting in the gloom? Don't you know my name yet? That's the only answer. Tell me, who are you, alone, yourself, and nameless? But you are young and I am old. Eldest, that's what I am. Mark my words, my friends. Tom was here before the river and the trees. Tom remembers the first raindrop and the first acorn. He made paths before the big people, and he saw the little people arriving. He was here before the kings and the graves and the barrel whites. When the elves passed westward, Tom was here already, before the seas were bent. He knew the dark under the stars when it was fearless. Before the Dark Lord came from outside.
So that is really old.
Yeah, once again, Tom just speaking in a loaded paragraph.
So that, well, all right. So basically, all these kind of things, you actually can find some references to these in the Silmarillion, actually, like the beginning of the Silmarillion. Like that's how far back we're going, and that thing starts with the creation of the world.
Cut me off if we don't have time for this type of thing, but you've given us some very good rundowns of the Silmarillion before.
Yeah.
Would you be able to give me a brief recap of Silmarillion Genesis?
Well, let's just take the lines here, and I'm just going to say what it's a reference to in there.
Cool. That's perfect.
Tom was here before river and trees. Tom remembers the first raindrop and first acorn. So that's like literally the world being created. So somehow his spirit's already around when that starts, apparently.
And who is creating the world?
The Valar. Luvatar?
Okay.
Originally in the music of the Ainur slash who become the Valar, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were all playing music, which that created a vision of the world.
Okay.
They thought they were making the world, but they actually weren't. And so Luvatar's like, all right, you see the vision. Now go into the world. You got to make it yourselves. And so like then the Valar all go in there. Melkor goes in as well. Melkor, who's also known as Morgoth, who's the main bad guy of the Silmarillion, he goes in there and he's going to destroy.
He's one of the...
He's the equivalent of one of the Valar, but he's not considered one. But yeah.
Understood. Well, Luvatar is the head god.
Right. So he's like above, and they're all kind of like... They function... Iluvatar functions like Christian god.
Okay. Like a little more abstract.
Yeah, and then the Ainur slash the Valar are more like angels, but then when they get into this world, they function more like the Greek gods.
Okay. More personified.
Yeah. Yeah, but so they're making the world, they're creating the world, and as they're creating stuff, Melkor is like kind of destroying it, you know, classic like good versus evil.
Right.
But yeah, then he made the paths before the big people and saw the little people arriving. So the big people, that would be any, probably men specifically, but more so elves.
Okay.
So like he made paths before the big people. So he was around before the elves. Oh, wait, I think that's in another line. The little people, that would be the hobbits. So he's here before hobbits. So he's going out of order of what he's here before. He was here before the kings and the graves and the barrow whites. So all we have to say here is, and as we move further west where we're going to see this, or further eastward, to the east of the old forest here was an ancient kingdom. Actually, we talked about it. Like, the hobbits used to be under a king, right? They had to get permission from a king to settle the Shire. There's an old kingdom of men just in the north here. And so that's what he's talking about there. But now all that was left of him was graves and barrow whites. When the elves moved westward, so now he's going way back to the Silmarillion again. So when the elves were first awoken, we talked about this in the third chapter with the elves, how they love Elbereth slash Varda. Because she was the star kindler, and it was after she put up basically, I think, what's the equivalent of the Big Dipper in the north. That's when the elves woke up, and the first thing that they saw was her starlight, because there was no sun and moon at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they love the stars. That's why they love Varda so much. But after they saw that, one of the Valar, the hunter god, whose name is Orome, he was riding his horse hunting around in the darkness of Middle Earth, and he stumbled upon the elves. And so basically, he convinced them that they should go to Valinor, which we remember is across the sea. And it's like the western sliver. Think of the eastern coast of the United States versus Europe. They went to there. So they cross over. But say that they woke up in the Middle East almost. The elves walk across Europe, which is where they would have seen Bombadil would have seen them walking by in his forest. And then they take a ferry across to Valinor and hang out there until it's time to come back for the main part of the Silmarillion. And he knew the dark under the stars when it was fearless. So that's just referring to all the time before the sun and moon was there. Oh, before I skipped over, before the seas were bent. So that's really weird. Originally, when the world was first created, it was flat. But there's one huge event after the Silmarillion, but before Lord of the Rings, where the earth actually becomes rounded. which I think we'll talk about it at some point. I'm just going to leave it at that, like, for now. And before the Dark Lord came from the outside. So I had to read the Histories of Middle-earth, the drafts, to figure out which reference he was talking about here. But the Dark Lord's definitely Morgoth, but it's kind of up for debate if it's when he's coming back after he escapes from Valinor, or if when he's coming back from early times while the gods are still building the world.
Okay.
You know, like, if it's that far back.
Right.
Either way, Tom's been here for a while. And
by a while, it means like all of it.
Oh yeah. So yeah. So we gotta just really upfront, like, start trying to pick out what he is here.
Yeah.
So here's one possible thing: is like, well, is he just God? Like, is he a Luvatar? Is he just, yeah, you know, did he somehow smuggle himself into this world, even though he's supposed to be the head god somewhere far off?
Right, which has good precedent in all sorts of different mythology. I can think of, like, you'll have to help me out with some of the specifics of Greek mythology, but, like, important god character masquerading as a crazy old man is, like, a classic theme in tons of mythology and stories.
Well, and here we actually get Olmo doing that a couple times, and, like,
right. Yeah. What was that? The College of Lost Play, or
he was actually, that was supposed to happen in some of the drafts or something, but, like, Olmo, like, big god Olmo, like, full presence, shows up to tour, but there were drafts where he would be kind of like the wandering old man.
Okay.
Which is like Odin.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very, very obvious example, but I'm not going to say it, because it's a huge, huge spoiler of somebody doing this in Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
I can't say it, though. Oh, well, I can tell you.
When, yeah, I know. Yeah, but there's something from the Odyssey that I'm thinking of.
Oh, yeah. Athena does that a lot. She hides herself up and dresses like as all the gods come down. And then I remember in this first chapter specifically, she comes to Odysseus' son, Telemachus, to encourage him to go on a journey to find his dad.
Okay. But am I making this up, or is that a classic thing in Greek mythology where the Greek gods love to impersonate random peasants and go down and talk to people?
That's a classic thing, but when we're dealing with Iluvatar, he's above the Greek gods. Like, this is a much more like
Kronos deal versus Zeus.
No, even higher than like Kronos.
Okay.
Like, yeah. I mean, we're dealing with, like, Christian gods, so that would be the only thing that would get close to that is, like, well, like, Jesus coming down.
Right.
Well, so is that going on here? My thinking was, and I think other people go from this too, is Goldberry's answer where he just says he is.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of sounds like the, in John's gospel, there's one part where Jesus is talking to the crowds like usual and everything, mm-hmm, and, like, they're all kind of, I don't know, like, they're not taking his words well, because he usually confronts people, basically. Mm-hmm. And basically, I think they were asking him, like, hey, so who do you think you are, almost, is what they're kind of saying. And he just says, before Abraham was, who's the father of all the Jews, before Abraham was, I am. And so when he said that, then all the people got super mad and they were about to go stone him. But then he, we don't know how, but he just left or got away or escaped or, mm-hmm, something. And so the I am part, like, that set them off, because that goes back to Moses in the burning bush, where Moses asked the Lord, he was just like, well, if you're going to send me all these people and I know you're the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but, like, who are you? And God's only response was, I am who am, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's where the I am comes from. Like, that's God's name.
Right.
The Judeo-Christian God's name is I am. Like, and it's just like, it's almost like a verb, like being itself.
Yeah.
So I thought that might have been a reference there with the Goldberry thing.
Yeah.
But as Joseph Pierce points out, and we're going to rely heavily on Joseph Pierce's answer to who Bombadil is here, he says, no, he can't be God, because Tom Bombadil, in all, like, his speeches here, he's too passive and detached. And God doesn't just remember the first raindrop, he sends it himself. Right. You know, he doesn't just peek out into the woods and watch as the elves go by.
Right, right.
I mean, he would be way more active in all this.
Yeah, so then maybe it's not so much what is Tom Bombadil, but what he is, but it's almost like he's not something. You know, like, he's unaffected by the ring and he can still see Frodo. It almost makes him seem like he's some sort of, like, detached spirit. He's almost like representative of something, and he's not a real, he's almost like not incarnate. Even if he can interact with the world, he's not real.
Well, yeah, I know what you mean, because I would say this guy, he probably wouldn't remember his birthday anyways, but this kind of guy, he probably didn't have a birthday. You know, whereas every other living thing, it's like they were created on this day and they were born this day, whereas he was kind of before all that.
Right.
And especially with the line, existed before the Dark Lord came from the outside, I think this is going to be the big tip-off that he's going to be our best example of a pre-fall being. So, like, you know, before the fall, like Adam and Eve fall, you know, he's going to be from before that time, like the age of innocence. So he's free of sin and corruption.
Okay. So he's almost like a, I don't know how to describe it. If, well, yeah, we've been talking about this sort of Cimmerillion Genesis, how all of Middle-earth was created. He's like a proto-Genesis. Like, he's like a character from a book before Genesis.
Yeah. Like, we've used the elves kind of as a reference to, like, they were what men looked like before the fall.
Okay.
But really, if you read the Silmarillion, the elves have definitely had a fall themselves of their own kind. So they're not the perfect comparison, whereas Tom is kind of actively like if you ever wanted to figure out, like, what was it like for Adam and Eve before they ate the apple? Like, what was, like, pure, yeah, innocence, basically, is the best word.
Right.
You know, no evil of anything to speak of.
Mm-hmm.
You can look to characters like Tom Bombadil, and that's, like, kind of an explanation with that. You know, like, Goldberry and him are, like, setting the table. That's the only reason I read that description was, like, talk about this here, how they're, like, flowing and weaving between each other, even though they're, like, a weird couple. You know, and the whole chapter, everybody's singing and, like, you know, instead of just talking in prose, they're very poetic and everything like that.
Right.
That's kind of what we're getting at here. What Tolkien had said himself was, so he had actually, all right, so after the publication, Tolkien was, yeah, always kind of elusive about talking about Bombadil, but he says he's an allegory, which, you know, that's very ironic because we had, like, a whole episode where he's just like, applicability, not allegory. So it's like, yeah, Tolkien, you were too far off on that. But he says he's like, think of him kind of as like pure natural science. Not so much science, you know, and you can pick any subject. You don't really have to pick science, but he's like, he's kind of the zoology and botany versus like cattle breeding and agriculture, you know,
right.
Like he's not practical science. He's science, like, you know, just pure abstract for the sake of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, so that gets back to what I was saying, where it's like, he's more symbol than being. He represents things and he is present in the chapter, but he's not really an actual character. Or maybe that's not the right words. But
I agree with what you're saying. But then, like, for the sake of the story, like, well, what's he doing here and everything? And so he's just an example for us as, you know, somebody that's uncorrupted, period.
Yes.
And so it's like, is he actually present and tangible? It's like, well, I don't know. He saved the hobbits and everything, and they're staying at his house and they're under his roof, and I don't know, maybe they touched him at some point, you know, like you could probably physically feel him. But yeah, I agree that he's not really part of the world, which of course is exactly why this ring had no effect on him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. He's like, he's beyond all that or above all that, kind of.
Or before all that.
Yeah, before all of it. And it's after evil arrives and has affected everything else, somehow it still hasn't affected Tom, whereas it has affected elves because they've had their own sort of fall, and it's affected even the Valar and everything, but somehow Tom doesn't have it. So he's literally free from, like, any sin, and or he's free from all that. Like, evil has no power over him whatsoever.
Which is amazing.
And that would also lead to another reason why the ring is a symbol for sin, because he's not infected by sin, which is why he's not affected by the ring.
Okay, cool.
To try to go more.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're really interested in this type of thing, or you're like this sort of reflection on background for a character like this is really exciting for you. A pretty intriguing book that I read, definitely like a little bit dense, but it's called Landscape and Memory. And it's technically an art history book, but it sort of stitches together history, art, architecture, science, culture across a pretty wide span of time. And the focus of the book is, or the sections are, wood, water, and rock. And the author basically breaks down how our culture, how different cultures have internalized and interpreted their mythologies about nature and their surroundings. And so a lot of the descriptions of culture as it relates to the forest in Europe and in England is really fascinating. And there's a lot of you could definitely like pull a lot of references or similarities to this, where like the projection of like a Sylvan ideal, or viewing sort of the Garden of Eden as a sort of paradise, and also tying that to how we interpret the forest, that type of stuff. So if that interests you, definitely recommend Landscape and Memory by Simon Shama, I think is the author.
Nice. Yeah, I don't know. We could keep talking about Bombadil, but
yeah,
I think
we gotta keep moving.
Yeah, I feel like we're gonna leave it open here. Maybe we'll have an opportunity to talk about him.
Yeah, I mean, certainly something I really loved about love about this chapter is that you can't really wrap it up. Like raises more questions than it answers.
But it's fun. Yeah,
you know, we've spent just about an hour now talking about answers to the questions that we clearly haven't like really pinned it down at all. So
yeah,
it's a cool chapter.
We got to finish up though. Just at the end of the conversation, he advises them to on how like which direction to leave the forest. I think they're just following the river up, and then they're going to cut across the downs in a day and avoid the barrows part. So like they're going to cut northeast towards the road.
So we've gotten the story, or maybe a little foreshadowing about the spooky Barrow Downs,
yeah,
and the whites, ghosts or something that live inside them.
Yeah.
And we know that the route is taking them near, but not too near,
right,
to the Barrow Downs.
And then if the chapter finishes off with the, you want to read the quote there?
Then he taught them a rhyme to sing if they should by ill luck fall into any danger or difficulty the next day. Ho, Tom Bombadil, Tom Bombadillo, by water, wood, and hill, by the reed and willow, by fire, sun, and moon, hearken now and hear us. Come, Tom Bombadil, for our need is near us.
Bedtime, chapter ends. Okay, Clifford, we're back again. Just finished up a doubleheader.
Mm-hmm.
For future episodes,
probably one of our most efficient, I'd say.
Yeah, especially since we were really experimenting with that chapter 10.
Yeah.
How you been?
I've been good. The rainy season has begun in San Francisco. Thanksgiving. I'm guessing you're gonna ask.
Yeah, how was that?
Thanksgiving was great. It was a particularly good year. Everything was very tasty, and then I had a somewhat harrowing drive across the country in a U-Haul van, U-Haul truck, I should say.
Yeah, how was that? Yeah.
I rented the smallest size truck I could get. I reserved the smallest truck because, you know, I'm moving like basically just barely like a really, really full car's load of stuff plus a couch and like a small table. So it's not that much stuff. And they gave me like quite a bigger truck than I reserved, which wouldn't be that bad, except that then when we were driving on I-80 across Wyoming, we had some like really, really bad crosswinds, and I felt like we were going to be blown off the road. So glad everything went okay. And
was your stuff like shuffling in the back because you didn't have enough?
I basically laid everything kind of flat as like one big layer. I was joking though that I probably could have set up my entire living room in the back of the truck, like because we live in a studio apartment. So it's, yeah. Anyways, things are good. Yeah. Back in the West Coast. How have you been?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. Thanksgiving was good for me. Yeah, been enjoying it, dude. I made a Advent playlist of songs that only anticipate Christmas. So like the deal is like if you say like "Will," like Santa Claus is coming to town, you know, like if you imply any sort of like future reference, it's like I'll play that song, but I won't play like the fun Christmas songs just yet because I want to like savor them and then go past Christmas, you know, for the whole 12 days.
Okay. So you're dealing with what, at least three different playlists for these different phases, or just two?
You're right. I am dealing with at least... Okay, yeah, because there's the... Well, I might just end up being two, because maybe I'm not going to put that much work into it. Then again, okay. It's not that much work. But it's like, yeah, there's definitely the Advent phase, but then it's when they light the pink candle, the Gaudete candle, I think it's called. Then it's like, all right, full steam, Christmas ahead, you can play all the stuff, and that's good until, like, probably New Year's, because then there's, like, you know, a couple good songs that it's like you can't play in January, but, like, the Wise Men don't come until then, so it's like you gotta wait a little bit for Three Kings, you know.
Okay.
Which is a classic. But there's that Christmas Is Coming by the Charlie Brown guy, the Vince Guaraldi guy. Uh-huh. That one's awesome. It's not the popular line, it's the Lucy one, it's the other one that's really good. And it's like Christmas Is Coming, it's like, oh good, I'm glad that's fair game for literally all of December.
Yes.
That's what I'm about. Yeah. Do we have a review?
I think we should.
Okay, so this one's from Not a Hobbit 5. Thorough, 5 stars. Great host, lots of information. The Instagram posts, really cool illustrations. Definitely recommend following. Alright, nice job. That's a beer koozie right there. Everybody, get on it. You can all do this. All right, well, yeah, I think that's about it for this one. Thanks for joining us. Everybody have a good Advent season as we continue on. I don't know. Cliff and I are really having fun with this. I'm speaking for him on this point. This has been a good day. Yeah, all right, everybody have a good night, good weekend, good week, whatever.
Thanks, y'all.